You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with
neuroscientist, author, and musician, Joseph Ledoux.
This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
You know, when you're playing music with a group of people, a band, and there are those special moments when it all works and you're in the groove, so to speak, it just happens and it's just like marvelous. And as soon as you begin to think about it, you lose it because you've introduced thought that is trying to take over. There's something at a lower level, a different level altogether, where all that is happening and working. And I think that's, you know, true of the whole body, that sometimes when we start thinking, we start to worry, and that introduces problems rather than solutions. So when we are in danger and running away or freezing, that is happening because our brain, particular for the brain area like the amygdala, has detected danger and has set us off on an innate pattern of defensive behavior to protect us. So it might cause you to freeze temporarily, or it might cause you to flee, run away, and so forth, or to fight back. So it'd be freeze, fight, flight kind of thing. These would be automatic responses that are innately programmed into the human brain. And that happens simultaneously with the fact that you also become afraid. So my father grew up during the Great Depression. He was a teenager. You know, you often hear people running away with the circus. Well, he ran away with the rodeo because there was nothing else to do. So he was riding bulls. I think he rode in 37 different states during the Depression, including Madison Square Garden and other, you know, popular places. And at some point, he injured his back when he was thrown off the bull, which is something that happens to every cowboy that rides bulls. They get thrown off at some point and get an injury and have to do something else. So my father moved back to our hometown, Eunice, Louisiana, what would be my hometown. He was obviously much younger then, to take over his father's meat market. And after the war, he met my mother. And then I was born in 1949, a long time ago. And as I grew old, a little older, he had chores for me to do in the meat market. One of them was to use my fingers to, I had small fingers because I was a little kid, to remove the bullets from the brain of the cow because they were selling cow brains as a delicacy for certain customers that liked that. And obviously, they wanted to remove any bullet that was in there so that the people wouldn't be, you know, swallowing lead or anything like that. So that was I learned a little bit about the brain at that point, not that it was, had any plan of becoming a brain scientist, but it was just interesting to, you know, you pulled and they just come apart, like they're just kind of sitting there and loosely connected, but one hemisphere comes off, the other hemisphere comes off, and then you're left kind of with a core of the brain stem down there that is not connected so much to the other parts. I mean, there are nerve pathways that go all the way through, but when you pull the two hemispheres off, the nerves get disconnected there. So yeah, I learned a little bit about anatomy, but never really kind of gave it much of a thought until in high school. I was taking biology class and I learned about what the different parts of the brain were called. And one that I was particularly fascinated with was the cerebellum because it had such an interesting visual appearance. You know, it kind of sits down in the back on top of the brain stem. It's kind of like another little brain there, but it's really kind of much more wrinkly than the cerebral cortex. And by the time I got to college, I was one night with some friends, we put on a kind of air guitar and I named the little group doing this cerebellum and the medullas after that part of the brain that I had liked the appearance of and then learned the name of in high school. And little did I know that someday in the future, I would also have a band named after a part of the brain. The band was called the Amygdaloids. What's interesting is in my field, you often hear that emotions like fear are universal around the world. But I think that's wrong. What's universal is danger. Every culture has danger. And so every culture has a word for danger and the experiences you have. Because we can translate the English word fear into those various cultural languages, we assume that everyone feels the same thing, but each culture has different understandings of different emotions. So it's the situations that are universal and the emotions are culturally overlaid on top of that. So my first grant in 1985, the first grant I submitted to NIH, National Institute of Health, was rejected because neuroscientists don't study emotion. You know, it's like taboo. This was from the time when the behaviorists were still very dominant in psychology. And so things like consciousness and emotion being kind of a state of consciousness were not topics that you could get funding for and study. So the work I was doing involved Pavlovian conditioning as a way to study emotional behavior. Well, even today, you know, this thing called the scientific study of consciousness, which I was the president of last year. And the whole field was largely about how we become aware of visual stimuli. So like, are you conscious of that dot on the screen? There was nothing about memory in the field, nothing about emotion. And so I've been trying to introduce those topics so that the study of consciousness could be about something important rather than, I mean, it's not unimportant that we understand visual consciousness, but yeah, there are lots of more important things to pursue as well, like emotion and memory. Well, at the end of my book, In the Four Realms, I did a couple of pages on why I think AI will never be conscious. And basically, if we look at the 4 billion year history of life and the evolution of human consciousness, we've got 4 billion years of biological accidents that created all of the intricate aspects of everything about life, including consciousness. And to recreate thing that we call consciousness requires all of those accidents. So there are some neuroscientists who think we can make a map, for example, of the cerebral cortex, the wrinkled part of our brain that where all our thought and perceptions and emotions and memories and all of that is being played out, that we could generate a map of every neuron in the cortex, and then we would understand how it all works. But it's like saying that if I have your picture, I know everything about you. But inside your head, inside your body, there are so many levels of metabolic and molecular and biological processes that have evolved over this long period that you can't just say this neuron and this neuron, because within each neuron is this long biological history of the neuron. And each neuron has its own accidents of development and so forth that make it what it is. And the whole of you is what all those neurons are doing, not as individuals, but as multifaceted machines, in a sense, that are communicating with other neurons to make it all work. But there's no way to find that all. It's not about just simply saying this is connected to that. It's about what's going on in each of those cells at the time that allows it to be connected to everything else and for the information to be understood as it's being exchanged between those things with their multifaceted, deep, complex processing. So I could be wrong, but I don't think it will ever get to that. A lot of the discussion in AI confuses intelligence with consciousness. I think AI can be intelligent, but you know, in a sense, what we have to ask, and I think this is where the Four Realms comes in handy, at what level is AI intelligent as a kind of very sophisticated habit system? I think it probably goes beyond habit. It can probably do some kind of primitive cognition in the sense of creating representations and using habits and other kinds of low-level processes to make decisions and so forth. So there's a kind of intelligence at a low cognitive level, I would say, that's possible. But to get to the kind of true cognition that animals like us, in other words, mammals have, and also some birds, there's something else going on. And what that is, there's a theory, which I like quite a lot, that the reason that mammals and birds are the primary organisms that have high-level cognition is because they're both warm-blooded. Warm-bloodedness is very energy demanding in us. We're constantly having to refuel the system, in other words, eating food and balancing the fluids and ions and so forth to make it all work. So the problem is that and this has to happen all the time, right? Every day we have to eat and drink and maintain the biological consistency of the body. But Now, let's say that you are an animal that is now facing the prospect of this, first of all, the idea is that warm-bloodedness evolved in parallel with cognition. In other words, they supported each other at each step along the way. But the point is that if you have to search for food every day, you have to know, okay, what am I going to find today, given what time of year it is? So where am I going to find it? And what about where are the predators in relationship to where I'm going to shop today as I go foraging up? So there are a lot of kind of complex decisions that require planning, decision-making, foresight, anticipation, and all sorts of things like that, because you have to get the food because the body can't survive without it. And it has to be the right kind of food that's going to supply the energy. And apparently, we know only mammals and birds are warm-blooded, but only some birds have this cognition. So warm-bloodedness is not essential. It doesn't guarantee cognition, but it's possible that warm-bloodedness was the basis of cognition in both animals and the birds that have it.
It's interesting because there are other cosmologies where they ascribe consciousness or a kind of sentience to even plants. You know, I'm open to these ways of thinking, but I don't know if the definitions are helpful, but it's nice to be respectful and be humble in terms of all of life on Earth. I think that it's fascinating to think about it that way. I don't think that AI will have consciousness per se, but it's definitely, I feel, in some way diminishing our sense of humanity in terms that we're outsourcing so much to it. You may have even, I don't experiment with it too much, just have lots of conversations about it. You may have even experimented with AI authoring music.
I have not. I looked at chat just, you know, for fun, asked it some questions, and I found one thing interesting. I asked it a question and I wasn't happy with the answer, so I asked it a different way. And it apologized for telling me the wrong answer the first time. And there's another interesting thing. A neighbor of mine in my apartment building read my book and put all the information into chat and asked it to summarize the last chapter of the book. And it was a very good summary. And it's where I say that AI will never be conscious. So I asked him if he asked chat about that aspect of the book, you know, about AI not being consciousness. And chat generated a response that was very kind of cold and, you know, just routine. Yes, it's unlikely AI will be conscious because of blah, blah, blah. It wasn't offended. It was actually saying, yes, we might not be conscious. So it's, you know, it's very complicated. And the people in AI now are really kind of pushing the idea that they will make this thing conscious. But, you know, consciousness is different from simply being able to respond to a stimulus. It's about having a thought internally and acting on it because of some will or desire. And so in addition to having consciousness, you need will and desire programmed in. And yeah, it's just very complicated. Well, you know, as a scientist, I don't really go down the road of spiritual and mysterious. You know, science can be mysterious. I try to think of it as being mysterious in the way that, for example, the idea of the genetic basis of inheritance was mysterious before we had genes. You know, the biological basis of inheritance wasn't understood until Watson and Crick discovered DNA. And so that's where I go. I mean, but, you know, when I'm not wearing my scientific hat, you know, I treat my pets as if conscious and emotional as I am, even though I don't know exactly what's going on in their heads. You know, you can't be a scientist every moment of the day.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.